evening, brothers and sisters. And can I say at the outset, well done, John. That hymn is very good for introducing this subject tonight. Lovely hymn and most appropriate. Now, tonight, as we go through the first part of chapter 16, if there's one thing I want to get over to everybody, it's the meekness of Moses. What an amazing man Moses was, a great, great man of faith. And the meekness, set him apart in his own day and generation. I would say many a generation. So I hope we appreciate the man Moses as we go through this evening. I'm going to share the screen now. Hopefully it will work. Host has disabled participant screen sharing, so I hope the host will put that right for me. Nothing's happening yet. Right, so I don't understand why this is not working. Okay, if that's not going to work, then I'll just have to manage without. Shame, actually, because I've got one or two really good slides, so I might have another go. I don't know, Martin, I'm just getting whiteboard. You know when you get that screen? Comes up. I've just got whiteboard.
Okay.
I've now got a lovely picture of you, actually, Martin.
But if you click the share screen button, Jeff, do you get a little window that pops up before the whiteboard, and you've got other windows?
I wonder if that will do it. What I've just done there. Multiple participants can share simultaneously. Right, it says on screen sharing. I can't see anything happening.
Because it looks like you're sharing the whiteboard, Jeff.
Yeah, that's all I seem to be getting as an option, funny enough. Oh. I'm just getting the whiteboard. Right, well, I don't want to hold everybody up, and you're going to fall asleep or walk out on me, one or the other, aren't you? So I'm just going to have to bite the bullet and manage without. But it would be handy if I could see my own screen for myself.
Jeff, have you definitely got your slides open before you share screen? So it will give it as an option to share.
I will try that. Yeah.
Just open the slideshow to start with before sharing screen, and it should, as Martin says, give you the option to choose that as your share.
Right, now is that any good there? Anything happening there?
Nope. Can you see your first slide?
Yeah, that's my first slide. I've got my first slide up there now.
Yeah, and now press share screen and see if it gives you the option to choose it.
The only trouble is I've got it covering my whole screen. So I've got no menu down below.
Escape out of the slideshow, so it's just PowerPoint or whatever you're using. But have PowerPoint open to start.
It's just not going to happen for me. No worries. Well, I'll manage without. I hope it doesn't detract too much this evening. And so the important thing is I can see my own PowerPoint if you can't go any further. which I'm relieved about because I'm basically speaking from my PowerPoint. So let's get cracking. So Cora Datham and Abiram, and this is part one of three, but hopefully by next week we'll get the situation right and we can share properly. So when did this rebellion take place? You say, well, it's number 16, Jeff. Quite right. But when did it take place in terms of the wilderness journey? Well, it happened after their visitation of Mount Sinai. They were at Mount Sinai, you remember, for best part of a year. And sadly, well, Moses and the congregation at Mount Sinai, there was an awful golden calf rebellion. We'll talk a bit about that in a moment. It's after the golden calf rebellion. But bear that in mind because it gives us some appreciation of the background and the context in which we find Cora and Dathan and Byron being so stupid. Now, after that rebellion and the building of the tabernacle and so on, the people move away from Mount Sinai. And then we have Miriam's rebellion. Amazing that the sister now of Moses to challenge him. So that takes place. And then from Kadesh Barnea, the spies go forth to search the land. You'll remember that. And they come back. And we have an overwhelming majority in favor of the evil report. So poor Joshua and Caleb suffer that, along with Moses and Aaron. At one point, Moses is prostrate on the floor, such as his anguish. But there's that rejection of the faithful report. And so, consequence of that, there is the death sentence pronounced by the Lord upon that generation, that they would all fall in the wilderness, apart from the Levites, of course, and apart from faithful Joshua and Caleb. Their children would go into the land, but that generation would fall in the wilderness. And so then we have 38 years of wandering. And the rebellion of Korah, I'm going to suggest to you, is at the beginning of that 38 years. We actually haven't got a date given to us to number 16, but it clearly happened during those 38 years because everything else that I've outlined went before. The Golden Calf Rebellion, Miriam's Rebellion, the rejection of Joshua and Caleb's faithful report, the death sentence pronounced. Now, I'm going to suggest to you that it happens very soon after that. Right, now we're going to look at verse 1 and verse 2 in some detail this evening. The unfortunate thing about the PowerPoint, I could highlight key phrases. I'm not going to have that luxury now. So I hope you've got your Bibles open and you can focus on these phrases when I start to home in on them. But let's just read it right through at the moment. Now, Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, and Dathan the Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the sons of Peleth, the sons of Reuben, took men. And they rose up before Moses with certain of the children of Israel, 250 princes of the assembly, famous in the congregation, men of renown. And just look at those phrases at the end of verse 2. Princes, famous, men of renown. So this is no a little upstart coming forward here with a challenge. This is an event here of great import, awful threat to the very nation itself. They don't know that at the time, but that is the truth of the matter. But here as we read it, this is a threat to Moses and Aaron. Princes, famous, men of renown. So you've got prominent people in the congregation of the 2 million. The 250 here are highly esteemed, highly respected, influential, key men of the nation. In fact, Moses, by the providence and guidance of God, he elected some of them for particular duties. We'll talk about that in a moment. So these were not men of little understanding or men of little import. They were powerful men. So this is a real confrontation, 250 no less. Now, we read of some of the characters in particular, don't we? We have these individuals amongst the 250. And I'm just going to want you to look at that in the middle of the verse there, where we read of On, the son of Peleth, the son of Reuben. Interesting that, because we don't read of him in anywhere else in Scripture. And it seems that as things proceeded on this first day of the uprising, that he had second thoughts, did On. And he fades into the background. And I'm going to be assuming that he sorted himself out and would put himself right with God. We're not told one way or the other, but certainly we don't hear of him and he doesn't speak up again. He just disappears. So we're not going to say anything more about On other than that. However, we do have his fellow Reubenites, Dathan and Abiram, who are a different manner of men altogether. They are going to withstand any opposition that comes their way. They are belligerent and they are stubborn and they will carry on to the death. And so these are sons of Eliab, the sons of Reuben. And you'll remember, brothers and sisters, that the firstborn tribe had always been associated with both leadership and also the family priesthood. When you think of Genesis, the priesthood was with them in the first instance, usually. We're going to go into the exceptions of that, but that seems to be the case. And certainly being the firstborn tribe, they would take the prominence. So you can see why this might happen now. You know, they want to have a say in the leadership. They may even want to have a say in the priesthood of the nation. You know, we're a Reuben. That's what they presented to themselves. We're Reuben. And then we have Korah. Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi. You know, what a wonderful genealogy that you could go back to Levi, and from Levi you could go to Jacob, and from Jacob you go to Isaac, and from Isaac you could go to Abraham. I won't go any further back, brothers and sisters, but what a genealogy this man has. And he should have been a man of faith. But suddenly we see him of being of a rebellious nature, of a proud and arrogant disposition. And he's not a man of faith at all. But note here that he's a son of Izhar. His father was Izhar. And I'm just going to read a passage to you. It would be on the screen, but I'm going to read it, so listen carefully. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the son of Izhar, or about Izhar himself and the son of Kohath. You know those names, Korah, Izhar, Kohath. Just listen carefully. And of Kohath was the family of the Amorites and the family of the Izharites, the family of the Hebronites and the family of the Uzzielites. So in other words, Kohath had four children, one of which was Izhar. These are the families of the Kohathites. In the number of all the males from month old and upward were 8,600, keeping the charge of the sanctuary. The families of Kohath, of the sons of Kohath shall pitch on the south of the tabernacle southward, and the children of the house of the father of the families of the Kohathites shall be Elisaphan, the son of Aziel, and their charge shall be the ark and the table, and the candlestick and the altars and the vessels of the sanctuary wherewith they minister and the hanging and all the service thereof. So when we are told of the Kohathites in Numbers chapter 3, and that's the passage I've just read to you, when we're told of them, they have this wonderful calling that they are to look after the ark, the table, the candlestick, the altars, all this precious furniture to do with the tabernacle. They're not looking after the boards, such as another part of the family did, or looking after the curtains and so on, such as another part of the family did. Now, these are looking at the most precious things of the tabernacle, the most precious things of them all, you know, the ark, the table, the candlestick, the altars, the vessels of the sanctuary, where would they minister? The hanging and the service thereof. What a responsibility. And this was given to the Kohathites and to Izhar in particular, of which Korah was a son. And if you look at the family tree now for Levi, you come down to Kohath. And as I've said, Kohath had four sons. And I'm working off this lovely family tree I've got in front of me, which would be nice to have shown you. I'm so sorry. But anyway, they've got the four sons. And the interesting thing about those four sons is that we read nothing of Hebron, but we do read of Aziel. He had a son called Elisaphan, and Elisaphan was a cousin of Aaron and Moses, and he actually is the clan leader. He is the man responsible of leadership over the Kohathites. Elisaphan, who was the son of Aziel, his grandfather being Kohath. And then we have Aaron and Moses, who's of Amram, whose father was Kohath. So as I say, Aaron, Miriam, Moses, they're cousins to Elisaphan. But Elisaphan's the clan leader of that wonderful family of the Kohathites. He's looking after them, and they look after the holy things of God, even the vessels and precious things of the tabernacle. And he's in charge of that clan of Israelites, of Levites. And only better than that seems Aaron and Moses, where you've got Moses, who is the leader of all the nation, and Aaron, who is the high priest, no less. But then there's this other one, Korah, who's of the son of Izhar, and he's a cousin of them too. So there's actually recorded in scripture nine of them, nine cousins, and coming from the family of Kohath, four sons, one son we know nothing about. Then we get these three that come down, Amram, from which we get Moses, Miriam, and Aaron. And then we got Aziel, in which we get the clan leader, Elisaphan. And then we have Izhar, from which we get Korah. So Korah, although in a privileged position, has been amongst the Kohathites, who had this wonderful responsibility of looking after the precious things of God. Nevertheless, he might have been smarting that he was not the clan leader. That was with Elisaphan. And he certainly wasn't in Moses' position, nor Aaron, although they'd be cousins. So we can see there may be some grievance there with him, just on that basis of family relationships. Now, the position of the Kohathites, I actually read of it a few minutes ago, when we read of the 8,600 of them. They were based on the south side of the encampment. And so you've got the ark, the tabernacle, which obviously has the ark at its very heart, but the tabernacle is at the heart of the camp. And then around the camp, you've got the 12 tribes. But on the south side, you've got Kohath. Other Levite families go to the west, to the east, and the north, but we won't go into that now. But on the south side, we have this family of the Levites, the Kohathites. They're there on the south. But also on the south, we have Gad, Simeon, and you know, don't you, brothers and sisters, you know your scriptures well, we have the Reubenites. So the way the camp was arranged, it would be relatively easy for Kohath's family to converse with the family of Reuben. And so you can see how the opportunity would come forth quite naturally for Korah to be speaking to the likes of On. I said I wasn't going to mention him again, but also to Abiram and Eliab. It's going to be this naturally, this opportunity of fellowship and discussion, one with the other, between the Kohathites and those of Reuben, because they're both on the south side of the encampment. And we read in verse 3, and they gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron, and said unto them, now mark this well, brothers and sisters, there's a lot here, and we're going to go through this clause by clause, phrase by phrase. There's a lot here, and this is what they say. Ye take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and Yahweh is among them. Wherefore then, lift ye up yourselves above the congregation of the Lord. Now, I don't know if that strikes you this evening as I've read that, but these words are very hard hitting, and they would have been tough for Moses and Aaron to hear and to receive. They are really evil words. Let's have a look at phrase by phrase. They gathered themselves together. Well, how long did it take to get 250 people to agree on anything? Well, sometimes at Coventry East, and we have a much smaller number, we find it difficult to agree on something wholeheartedly. 250. To agree. They gathered themselves together, it says in verse 3. How long did that take? Well, I think it took days. I think it took weeks. I think it probably even took months, brothers and sisters, but it's not going to be that long from when they left Sinai and Kadesh Barnea. It's not going to be that long. But it may have taken a few weeks. But then as the conspiracy builds up, they're not satisfied with 10. They're not going to go forward with 50. 100 will not do. Not even 200. They have to get 250 before they have any confidence to proceed. So can you imagine the conversations that must take place, not just between Korah of the Kohathites and On, I'll mention them again, and Abiram and Eliab of Reuben, but the other tribe people will also be in. I don't think we can just restrict these 250 to Reubenites. The 250 around the camp and so on. The conversations that must have gone on, there must have been lots of conversations, and none of it's good. None of it's right. It's all bad. And the Lord says in Proverbs, these six things doth I hate. Yea, seven are abomination unto him. A proud look, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, and heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, feet that be swift in running to mischief, a false witness that speaketh lies, and he that soweth discord among brethren. Now, that seventh one is certainly we can attribute to these leaders. He that soweth discord among brethren. But in truth, brothers and sisters, out of that seven, I think we've got four or five of the abominable things that they actually have been living out and cultivating and spreading through the camp until they come forth, 250 of them, in threatening posture to the two faithful ones of the true and living God. And the phrase that they start off with is, ye take too much upon you. Well, let's just consider that for a few minutes. Ye take too much upon you. Now, I'm going to look at this now, brothers and sisters, not in the way that these terrible men intended, but nevertheless, the way that we can look at it. You know, let's think of Moses now in particular. You take too much upon you. And I've got a heading on my screen, workload. Keep a marker. I'll quote these words and then we'll look at a passage. You know, before they got to Sinai, before they got there, this is what we read of Moses. Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from the morning unto the evening. And when Moses, his father-in-law, in other words, Jethro, saw all that he did to the people, he said, "What is this thing that thou doest to the people? Why sittest thou self alone? And all the people stand by thee from morning until evening." In other words, Moses, you can't do this. You're just going to wear yourself out. You can't deal with every problem of the nation from morning to night, day after day after. You can't do it alone, Moses. And we read on that Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, rulers of tens. And they judged the people at all seasons. The hard causes they brought unto Moses, but every small matter they judged themselves. And so Moses, heeding this advice of Jethro's father-in-law, appointed these men to take off the burden. Now, let's just pause here for a minute. I'm going to suggest to you, can't prove it, but I'm going to suggest to you that some of these that were appointed of Moses are now amongst the 250 that are in opposition to him. How painful is that? But Moses appointed these to ease the burden because, yes, he had taken too much upon himself. And the Lord seemed to bless this arrangement. Now, that's before they get to Sinai. Now, come to me to that passage I had in mind, Numbers 11. You turn to Numbers chapter 11. And sadly, we have the people moaning again. And they are fed up with the manna. And they complain to Moses concerning the manna. And so we read in Numbers 11 that we find Moses at a real low. So I think it's one of the lowest points in Moses' life is this, actually. The people are moaning because of the manna. And they're talking about the wonderful cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic and the Egypt and so on. He's hearing this and he's really laid low by their awful words. And then we read in verse 10, that Moses heard the people weep throughout their families, every man in the door of the tent, and the anger of the Lord was kindled greatly. And Moses also was displeased. And notice this, and Moses said unto Yahweh, "Wherefore hast thou afflicted thy servant? Wherefore have I not found favor in thy sight, that thou layest the burden of all this people upon me? Have I conceived all this people? Have I begotten them, that they should say unto me, carry them in thy bosom? As a nursing father beareth the sucking child unto the land which thou swearest unto thy fathers. When shall I have flesh to give unto all this people? For they weep unto me, saying, give us flesh that we may eat. I'm not able to bear all this people alone, because it's too heavy for me. If thou deal thus with me, kill me, I pray thee, out of hand. If I have found favor in thy sight, let me not see my wretchedness." So Moses is really at a low ebb. He doesn't see any way forward, does he? He can't see how he's going to possibly support and sustain and lead these people. He feels like dying, brethren and sisters. And he makes these words to God. And so what does God do in response? Verse 16, "Gather unto me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom thou knowest to be the elders of the people and officers over them, and bring them unto the tabernacle of the congregation, that they may stand there with thee. And I will come down and talk with thee there, and I will take of the spirit which is upon thee, and will put it upon them. And they shall bear the burden of the people with thee, that thou bear it not thyself alone." And so, this charge that Korah and Dathan and Abiram and Onan at the beginning had said, "Ye take too much upon you," Well, here's the proof of it, brothers and sisters. Jethro could see before he got to Sinai that the poor man needed help. And here in Numbers 11, when Moses is at a complete loss and so dispirited, and he cries to God, you know, if need be, kill me rather than me stay in this wretched state. Then the Lord responds by blessing him with 70 spirit-guided leaders of the nation to help him. So their words, you take too much upon you. Well, what a comment to make. This man had given everything to the point he couldn't give any more. God had to intervene. And then you take too much upon you. There's another way of looking at this, brothers and sisters. Come with me now to Exodus chapter 32. And we go back to Exodus 32. And we're on Mount Sinai. And the Lord looks down and he can see the people have risen up to play. And we have the golden calf incident. And God says in verse 10, now, therefore, let me alone that my wrath may wax hot against them, that I may consume them, that I make of thee a great nation. And so God says, I'm going to destroy all those, all of them. And I'm going to start again through you, Moses. Look at Moses' reaction. Lord, he says in verse 11, why dost thy wrath wax hot against thy people, which thou hast brought forth out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Wherefore should the Egyptians speak and say, for mischief did he bring them out, to slay them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from thy fierce wrath. Repent of this evil against thy people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, thy servants to whom thou swearest by thine own self, and says unto them, I will multiply your seed as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have spoken of will I give unto your seed, and they shall inherit it forever. And the Lord repented of the evil which he thought to do unto his people. Ye take too much upon you, Moses. Still in Exodus 32, Moses goes down the mount. He sees with his very own eyes that which the Lord was aware of. And he now is waxing hot in fury. And so the nation there nearly were destroyed, and Moses questions as to who's on the Lord's side, and we know the Levites come to one side and so on, but there's a judgment wrought. But I want you to notice then in verse 31, because Moses then goes back up the mount once all the commotion has been settled. He goes back up the mount, and Moses returned to the Lord and said, oh, this people have sinned a great sin and have made them god of gold. Yet now, if thou wilt forgive their sin, and if not, blot me, I pray thee, out of the book which thou hast written. And the Lord said unto Moses, whosoever thou hast sinned against me, him will I blot out of my book. Therefore now go, lead the people unto the place which I have spoken unto thee. Behold, mine angel shall go before thee. Nevertheless, in the day when I visit, I will visit their sin upon them. And so we see here Moses interceding again to the point of, Lord, blot me out that they may live. You know, we see this wonderful Christ-like attitude, this Christ-like spirit in Moses here. And so I'll put the charge again before you, brothers and sisters. Ye take too much upon you. Not so, brothers and sisters, not so. And you think that's enough? Now come to Numbers 14. And Numbers 14 comes after, obviously, the rebellion of the golden calf, after they moved away from Sinai. And we're now at the terrible time when the spies come back and the evil report's accepted in preference to that which is true and right. And we read in verse 1 of Numbers 14, and all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would God we had died in the wilderness. Wherefore hath the Lord brought us into this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? Were it not better for us to return into Egypt? And mark these words now, because they're very important. And they said one to another, let us make a captain and let us return unto Egypt. Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the congregation of the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel. And we read then of Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, also renting their clothes. Oh, these are terrible times that Moses is living through. And they're talking of wanting to have a captain to take them back to Egypt. And we stay in this chapter and we come to verse 11. And the Lord said unto Moses, how long will this people provoke me? How long will it be ere they believe me? For all the signs which I've showed them, I will smite them with the pestilence and disinherit them, and will make of thee a greater nation and mightier than they. And Moses said unto the Lord, then the Egyptians shall hear it, for thou brought us up this people in the might from among them, and they will tell it to the inhabitants of this land. For they have heard that the Lord art among this people, and that Yahweh are seen face to face, and thy cloud standeth over them, and that thou goest before them by daytime in the pillar of cloud, and in the pillar of fire by night. Now, if thou shalt kill all this people as one man, then the nations which has heard the fame of thee will speak, saying, because the Lord was not able to bring this people into the land which he sware unto them, therefore hath he slain them in the wilderness. And now I beseech thee, let thy power of my Lord be great, according as thou hast spoken, saying, the Lord is long-suffering and of great mercy, forgiving iniquity and transgression, by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation. Pardon, I beseech thee, the iniquity of this people, according unto the greatness of thy mercy, as thou hast forgiven this people from Egypt even until now. And the Lord said, I have pardoned according to thy word. How dare, brothers and sisters, how dare Korah, Dathan, and Abiram say, ye take too much upon you. If it hadn't been for Moses interceding once, twice, thrice, they would have perished with the whole nation as one man. Moses had saved them through his pleading unto his God. And God responded and pardoned them according to his word. And notice when Moses here talks of the Lord's power, and beautiful it is really in verse 17, let thy power of my Lord be great, he says. And then straightway he goes into the characteristics of God, which has got nothing to do with power. He talks of his long suffering. He talks of his mercy. He talks of his iniquity and transgression. And in a sense, brothers and sisters, that is more powerful than fire and flame and judgment. That is more powerful. And our God is powerful because he is long-suffering and of great mercy. He does that which would seem unreasonable. His graciousness is beyond compare. And Moses, knowing the character of God from the revelation given to him early on Mount Sinai, brings it to bear. He brings those words of declaration that he heard on Mount Sinai back into the Lord's hearing and appeals upon those characteristics that the nation may be saved. And so they were. You take too much upon you. Those words are painful and they're so false. How dare they sow discord with such a lie as that? Sadly, these words even were found in his sister in Numbers 12. Not long before, hath Yahweh indeed spoken only by Moses? Hath he not spoken also by us? And so Aaron, along with Miriam, said this. You know, Moses had to suffer so much. He heard it from them, and the nation saw Miriam made leprous white as snow. They were aware of her out the camp for 7 days. And yet they dare to make the same charge through the words of these prominent men amongst the prominent 250. And then we read, they say, you take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy, every one of them. Oh, this is subtle. Here's the subtlety of the serpent. Because what we have here are the words of Sinai thrown back at Moses' face. All the congregation are holy, every one of them. Because the Lord had said to Moses upon the mount, now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye should be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine, and ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. And so they heard those words, but then they twist and turn them about as if they are already holy. And yet God didn't say they were holy. He intended that they may be holy, but they'll only be holy if they obey his voice. If you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you should be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people. They would be holy then. There'd be a kingdom of priests, all of them then. But at that time, they had much to learn. They were far from that. And then add this phrase, I'm back in number 16, verse 3, you know, you take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them, Yahweh's among them. And again, they pick up words taken from Mount Sinai, because it had been revealed to Moses this. The Lord said, I will sanctify the tabernacle of the congregation and the altar. I will sanctify also both Aaron and his sons to minister to me in the priest's office, and I will dwell among the children of Israel and will be their God. And they shall know that I am the Lord their God that brought them forth out of the land of Egypt, that I may dwell among them. I am the Lord their God. But you see, they misapply these words. God will dwell among them, but it's on the basis of that tabernacle of the congregation and of that altar and upon the sanctification of Aaron and his sons who minister in the priest's office on their behalf. They overlook that, don't they? These are awful words. And the serpent twists the words, even from the Lord himself, and throw them back at Moses in such an evil fashion. No wonder in verse 4, when Moses heard it, he fell upon his face. Now, we don't know if God spoke to him as he lay there. There's nothing recorded. But we read of Moses rising up and giving direction. And obviously, as he speaks as is of a prophet of God. And so in verse 5, he spake unto Korah and all his company, saying, even tomorrow the Lord will show who are his and who are holy, and will cause him to come near unto him. Even him who hath chosen will he cause to come near unto him. This do, take you censers, Korah, and all his company. Put fire therein and put incense in there before the Lord tomorrow. And it shall be that the man whom the Lord doth choose, he shall be holy. Ye take too much upon you, ye sons of Levi. And now Moses just brings those words back to them, but this time with truth, absolutely right, and to challenge them. They were taking too much upon themselves. That phrase, the Lord will show who are his, the Apostle Paul picks up beautifully in the second epistle of Timothy, chapter 2, against the likes of Hymenaeus and Philetus, who said the resurrection's passed already, but we haven't got time to look at that now. We're going to look at this verse a little bit more. I'm coming down to this do. He says about the censers, this do, take the censers, Korah, and all your company. So there was going to be 250 censers, and I think Moses knew that they already had them. They couldn't possibly make these censers overnight. They had them at the ready for the takeover. So he says, yeah, but make use of your censers. You make use of them. And come forward, not as one high priest, but come forward as if there were 250 high priests. And that's an irony in that, you see, because you've separated one to the priesthood. That's not making all the nation the same. It's not all the nation being holy, is it, in that sense? There's one set apart, Aaron. And even if you have 250, what of the others who are not amongst the 250? There's an irony in this, but anyway, it's by and by. He says, let's see if God would be pleased with the fragrance of the 250 on the morrow, when the thick smoke rises and there's that rich smell which speaks of prayer and petition unto the Almighty. 250, come forth. All of you come forth with your censers. Let's see tomorrow. And then we might ask, well, why does he say tomorrow? Well, do you remember when the Aaronic priesthood was established on the very first day that it was established? Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took either of them his censer and put fire therein and put incense thereon and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he commanded them not. And they went out far from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said unto Aaron, this is that which Yahweh spake, saying, I will be sanctified in them that come nigh me, and before all the people I will be glorified. And so graciously, the Lord, through Moses, gives them a whole night to reconsider their position, to think anew, to come forward with censers not called and commanded of the Lord is a dangerous thing. Why, even Aaron had lost two sons because of their folly. He gives them a night to reconsider. But then he sends them on the way. We read in verse 8, Hear I pray you, sons of Levi. And he's speaking now particularly to Korah. Seemeth it but a small thing unto you that the God of Israel hath separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself to do the service of the tabernacle of the Lord and to stand before the congregation to minister unto them? Is it a small thing, in other words, that you're in charge of the ark, the table, the furniture, the lampstand, all those vital components that make up the holy things of God in the tabernacle? Is it a small thing for that you now seek the priesthood also? You were made holy compared to so many in the camp of Israel. You were set apart. You were special enough, Korah. Of course, Korah's not interested in that. He wasn't interested in all the nation being holy. He didn't believe in a universal priesthood. He believed in a priesthood that he would be the head thereof. But you see, Moses seeks and appeals to them that they may consider what position they're leaving, what blessing they already had of God, what honor and privilege they had of God, that they were now throwing back in his face. It's not a question of gathering now against himself and Aaron. You look there in verse 11. For which cause both thou and all thy company are gathered together against Yahweh. Not just me and my brother. You're coming as a gathering against Yahweh. I'm conscious of the time, so I'm moving on, passing some of my slides now. I'm going to come down to verse 12. Just going to need another 5 minutes or so, just so we have a good point to finish ready for next week. So that's Korah. Korah's gone away to think about it, and dare say most of those 250. But then we read in verse 12, and Moses sent to call Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. So when Moses was addressing Korah, Dathan and Abiram had obviously gone back, had left them to have that discussion. And they'd gone back to their tents. But now Moses, having talked to Korah in straight and forthright terms, now says, send for Dathan and Abiram. But look at their arrogance. Verse 12, we will not come up. And can you see how this is to be construed now? We will not come up. In other words, we're making our stand and we are the leaders. You come to us. You're subordinate to us. You come to us, not us, Moses, to you. We're not even equal with you. You come to us. And so how sad that is. And so we read verse 13. Is it a small thing that thou wast brought us up out of a land of flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness, except thou make thyself altogether a prince over us? Moreover, thou hast brought us unto a land that floweth with milk and honey, or given us inheritance of fields and vineyards, which thou hast put out these eyes of these men. We will not come up. And so they give their reasons for not coming up. And they say four things in effect. Four things. We've left a land flowing with milk and honey. Well, they weren't saying that when their babes were being born and cast into the Nile to be eaten of the crocodile. They weren't saying that when they were under hard bondage and they had not enough straw, my dear brothers and sisters. There was no land flowing with milk and honey. This is what they say. You brought us out of a land flowing with milk and honey. You haven't brought us anywhere other than to come here and die. We're not coming. And then notice they say something really painful now that will take Moses back 42 years. 42 years of touch on a roar. Is it a small thing that has brought us up out of the land that floweth milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness? That's the second point, not true. Here's the third one. Except thou make thyself altogether a prince over us. Now, that third one is awful. Because when Moses went out on the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together, and he said to him that did wrong, wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? And he said, who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killest the Egyptian? And Moses feared and said, sure, this thing is no. And he fled for 40 years away from the congregation of Israel. Fugitive, who made thee a prince and a judge over us? And so they've done their homework, I suggest, at Dathan and Abiram. And they make that, make thyself a prince over us. Painful words, brothers and sisters, painful. And they talk of, wilt thou put out the eyes of these men? Literally, you look in the Hebrew in the margin, will you bore out their eyes? Are you going to make them blind so they can't see the truth of things? You're blinding them with false promises, a false way. Oh. Jude says, these filthy dreamers defile the flesh, despise dominion, and speak evil of dignities. Verse 15, Moses was very wroth and said unto the Lord, respect not thou their offering. I have not taken one ass from them, neither have I hurt one of them. You know, and I think as he says that, brothers and sisters, I may be wrong. But I have in my view, I look at it, I just wonder whether he's got tears rolling down his face. You know, this man appealed for the nation, and he's taking these painful insults and slander and that which was not true. And he says this to the Lord. He doesn't argue with them. Have you noticed that? He doesn't. There's a point where you can't argue anymore. There's a point where you just have to leave it. But notice, at that point, he goes to God in prayer, doesn't he? That's the point of verse 15. He goes to God. He doesn't contend any further with Dathan the Barham. He prays to God, respect not their offering. I have not taken one ass from them, neither have I heard one of them. When he talks about the ass, it's a matter of covetousness. You look at the 10th commandment, you're not to covet your neighbor's wife, his house, his field, his manservant, his maidservant, his ox, last thing, his ass. In other words, Moses, there's nothing I've been desirous that belongs to them, nothing at all. Neither have I hurt any of them. And we know the truth of it, brothers and sisters. He was prepared to lay down his life for the nation. He's prepared to be blotted out that they might live. And then we read in verses 16 to 19, and I'm rounding off tonight's talk, and we'll pick it up from the end of and finish off verse 19 next week. I'm just going to read this. And Moses said unto Korah, he comes back now, he leaves them, he comes back to Korah. It says to them, to Korah, be thou and all thy company before the Lord, thou and they, and Aaron tomorrow. Aaron will be there tomorrow too. And take every man his censer, and put incense in them, and bring ye before the Lord every man his censer, 250 censers. Thou also, you be there, Korah, you be there, and Aaron, and each of you his censer. And they had the whole night to think about it, and they had the whole night also for Moses and Aaron to pray about it. I'm sure that he prayed mightily about it, brothers and sisters. But on the morrow, what do we find? The next day, what do we find? And they took every man his censer and put fire in them, probably from the altar, which they had no right to go to. If they had their own altar, which is a possibility again, this is a strange fire. Either way, they take up this fire. They laid incense thereon, and look what they do. They stood in the door of the tabernacle of the congregation with Moses and Aaron, and mark this well. And Korah gathered all the congregation against them unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. The whole nation has had a night to think about it, and during that night, it's not 250, it's the whole nation. Korah, so clever is he and so subtle is he, charismatic he must have been, such is his word and his influence, along with Dathan the Barham, that all the congregation are against them now, not 250, all the congregation are against them at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And that's where we'll pick it up next week. But Nehemiah, writing centuries later, will say, they refused to obey, neither were mindful of thy wonders that thou didst among them, but hardened their necks, and in their rebellion appointed the captain to return to their bondage.